Good afternoon. I'm Bob Kruger with this episode of Thought for Food for December of 2023. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be of interest to everyone. Dates to remember this month: the third is the first day of Advent, the seventh is Remember Pearl Harbor Day, and the first day of Hanukkah. The 10th is Human Rights Day, the 13th is the birthday of the National Guard, and the 15th is the Bill of Human Rights Day. Winter begins officially on the 22nd, Christmas Day is the 25th, and Kwanzaa begins on the 26th, and we end the year on New Year's Eve on the 31st. Now here's an interesting story I want to share with you. It appeared in October in a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania newspaper. It begins: "This is often the time when home gardeners harvest the bounty of their summer growing season. Retired educator and city planner Evan Stoddard and his wife Janet are busy picking the pears, peaches, figs, and plums they grow in their South Side flats garden, along with baskets full of squashes, eggplant, beans, chard, garlic, and chives. They also snip many, many plump Concord grapes that come from the vines they planted more than 40 years ago on fences next to the Norfolk and Southern Railway tracks that pass through the neighborhood and by their backyard. This year, as always, the vines are so heavy with clusters of the thick-skinned purple fruit that their aroma hits you before you step into the patio. We used to have them everywhere," Evan says, as he worms his way through the tomatoes to a nearby vine and picks a fat bunch for display, which is not surprising because the perennial grapevine, if not pruned regularly, grows to a height of 6 feet. Much of the fruit is squeezed into the juice that's put up in the basement for later enjoyment. The couple also cooks the grape skins and pulp with an equal amount of sugar into a sweet, fragrant, and very purple jam. Yet the dish they look forward to each fall is one you might never heard of if you didn't grow up in Massachusetts or the Finger Lakes region of New York: a double-crusted grape pie. Both Evan and Janet were raised in farming families that knew the regional pastry well, he in Rochester, New York, and she in Chatham, New Jersey. Yet they didn't actually make the pie themselves until around 1978, when Evan gifted his wife a vintage copy of Imogene Walcott's The Yankee Cookbook, and they were looking for ways to use their abundance of Concord grapes at the time. And wouldn't you know it, there was a great recipe for Concord grape pie on page 216. So they tried it, and the fall tradition for their family of eight was born. Concord grape pie now makes a regular appearance on the kitchen table until the first frost, when the grapes, which turn from bright green to reddish to dark purple, are in season. There are probably as many recipes for grape pie as there are cooks, for each baker putting their own spin on the final product with different crusts, toppings, thickeners, and spices. That explains why the couple messed with the original recipe quite a bit over a period of time until it hit on what they consider a perfectly interpretation of the quintessential upstate New York dessert. Wonderful jammy, the filling pairs perfectly with Janet's mother's golden flaky double pie crust made the old-fashioned way with Crisco shortening. Concord grapes were first propagated from wild seeds by metal worker turned farmer Ephraim Bull in 1849. And after the grape won first place at the Boston Horticultural Society exhibition in 1853, it went to market and grew in popularity. Concord grapes eventually came to New York in the 1870s, and today the grape's major growing regions include the Finger Lakes region, Lakes Erie in Ontario, southwestern Michigan, and Washington's Yakima Valley. The fruit is mainly used for juice. Teetotaler Dennis Thomas Welch invented the process in 1869, but it was also used to make wine, candy, soft drinks, and many jars of grape jelly. You have seen many good jars of Welch's grape jelly on store shelves. You may have one in your pantry. And they're so good to just eat, says Janet as she pops one in her mouth. But many might be turned off because of the big seeds and the tough skin. I'd like to sample her pie. What is there about the triangle that seems to draw food companies to this area? Whatever it is, food companies seem to feel that they can succeed here, and we have several we'll tell you about. The Tampa, Florida-based chain Capital Tacos has signed a deal with a local couple to open franchise restaurants in the Triangle. The chain recently opened a company-owned location in Charlotte, the first in North Carolina. This new Raleigh restaurant would be the first franchise location in the state. The Raleigh franchise owners are David and Sylvia Robertson, an apex couple with careers in tech sales and restaurant hospitality. This deal is for one Raleigh location, expected to open in the spring of 2024. This really feels like a full circle moment, David said in a press interview. Sylvia and I met working in a restaurant out in Las Vegas 30 years ago, and now we're realizing a dream and opening one together. And doing so with a brand that values quality and guest experience as highly as Capital Tacos does reaffirms that this shift in lifestyle is the right move to make. In a telephone interview, Mr. Robertson describes how he and his wife, as passionate foodies, and jumping into this restaurant ownership has always been our dream. We just enjoy food, all kinds of food, he said. Good food has always been an interest of ours, and we want to center on something we're passionate about. The couple moved to Wake County in 2007, and he said he hopes to open the new Capital Tacos in the southeast part of the county. The Triangle Restaurant will be the company's first franchise location in North Carolina. They already have locations in Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, and Colorado, with plans to open in Oklahoma and New Jersey. Capital Tacos first opened in 2013 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. The menu at Capital Tacos hits as on many of the modern taco trends, like hot chicken and quesada fillings, salads, and homemade chips. Capital Tacos will jump into a Triangle taco scene that's getting more crowded with out-of-town brands. Recently, the popular Torchy's Tacos opened its second Triangle location, and the D.C. area Taco Bomba was scheduled to open its first Raleigh location this summer. This story appeared in the November 4th issue of the News and Observer. It would be interesting to see if the line for fried chicken fingers at the new Raisin Cane's on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill will be as long as the line for people waiting in the Chapel Hill local election line. Keniacs have waited over 2 years to see Raisin Cane launch its downtown Chapel Hill location. The store at 10 East Franklin Street was scheduled to open November 7th with a lucky 20 drawing that would give 20 customers free chicken fingers for a year. Customers must be 18 or older to win. The company is excited to be opening in another iconic college town, said the company spokesperson. Historically, college students love us, and we can't wait to show UNC students that our one love, good chicken fingers, is all about, she said. Raisin Cane's has been working to get the Brockwell building at the corner of Franklin Road and Columbia Streets ready since early 2021. In December 2021, Raisin Cane's Restaurants LLC bought the building, which includes a Starbucks. The renovations were expensive, with the interior gutted and refurbished. The roughly 5,500-square-foot restaurant will have a few seats on the first floor, with a rest for food prep, checking out and picking up, and an elevator to the second floor, which extends into space over Starbucks. About 100 seats are approved, with 8 for sidewalk dining. Raisin Cane stores are generally open from 10 a.m. to late night. We built a beautiful, non-traditional Raisin Cane's that fully embraces Chapel Hill in cool, unique ways, when speaking of this Franklin Street location. It's a multi-level restaurant, so getting it ready to open has taken longer than expected. Only two other Raisin Cane restaurants are in North Carolina, at Camp Lejeune and at East Carolina University. But the company has that started at Louisiana State University in 1996 has several hundred other locations nationwide. One of the country's hottest burger brands is scheduled to open its first Raleigh location in the Village District in November. Shake Shack announced that it will open in Raleigh on November the 9th. This marks the famous hamburger shop's third full-service triangle location, following spots in Cary and Chapel Hill, plus another counter location at the PNC Arena. The Triangle's first Shake Shack opened in Cary's Waverly Place Shopping Center in 2019, debuting with long lines of fans braving hot August heat. Shake Shack has become a fast casual icon for its take on the roadside smash burger made with thin griddle patties, squishy tomato potato buns, and crisply cut fries. The brand is also popular for its chicken sandwiches and their custard-based milkshakes. The Raleigh location will be the seventh Shake Shack in North Carolina, opening a 3,678-square-foot dining room and a 600-square-foot patio. The first 100 people through the door will go home with free Shake Shack swag, whatever that is. The Raleigh Shake Shack will be open from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week, located at 2010 Clark Avenue in the Village District. Fans of Achaia Bowls and Smoothies in downtown Chapel Hill will get to keep hanging out with friends, listen to music, or just people watching when the Purple Bowl restaurant reopens in its new location next year. Taylor Gilland, who owns a restaurant with his mother, told the News and Observer that the business would relocate to 505 West Franklin Street by August of 2024. We're really excited about it. We signed the lease. It's just what we want. It's a historic building. It's an older building that's been vacant for a while. So we're going to transform it from vacant office space into retail space for our cafe, Mr. Gilland said. The Gillands will spend the next 9 months creating a light, airy space and replacing the parking lot on West Franklin Street with an outdoor space three times bigger than the current patio, with room for a separate order window, a stage for live music, a shuffleboard court, and a big television. I think it's going to be a real cool space and a really fun little project, he said. The new restaurant will be 3,500 square feet larger than the present location. The addition of Purple Bowl will add to the funky vibe that has developed at the west end of Franklin Street in the past few years. From the Beer Study, the local 506, and Al's Burger Shop, Lapin Blue, the Baxter Arcade, Brandwine's Bagels, and El Fogon, whom we've written about. It would seem that West Franklin Street in Chapel Hill is wall-to-wall dining places. The question has been asked many times. Is it okay to eat canned foods after their use-by date? Canned foods, as well as other non-perishable foods like dried grains, are usually fine to eat even when past the date on the label. That's because the best used-by, or used-by designations on cans are manufacturer's best guess for how long the canned food will look and taste fresh, rather than how safe it will be to eat after that date. The one exception to this used-by date is on instant formula. In any event, you aren't likely to notice the difference in quality if you open a can whose used-by has only recently passed. Most canned foods, tuna, soups, and vegetables can be stored for 2 to 3 years after purchase. A few types, acidic foods such as tomatoes, pickles, canned juices may need to be used more quickly, within a year to 18 months, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. How can you tell if what's inside the can is okay to eat? First, when you open a can, trust your nose. Foul odors are a sign to toss it. Also throw away any can if it has any deep dents, bulges, or rust. All can signal possible dangerous bacteria inside. Finally, the USDA offers a free app which helps you to determine if it's been stored in the pantry or how long it will last in your refrigerator once it's been opened. It's 4 days in the fridge for most opened canned goods. This information came from the Consumer Reports magazine. A creative Kerry Burger Shop, known for its hard-to-find sodas, is expanding into Raleigh with a new location. The popular Corbett's Burgers and Soda Bar will open a new location in the Wakefield Crossing Shopping Center off New Falls and Noose Road in North Raleigh. This will be the third Corbett's location, following the original in Kerry, and a new one expected to open in Sanford in November. The new Raleigh Corbett's hopes to open in February, said owner and namesake, Corbett Shope. We have a lot of customers in that area of the county who always ask to open one over there, he said. Whenever they come and visit us, they say we wish we could shop more, but Kerry's on the other side of town. Mr. Shope opened the first Corbett's in Kerry in 2012. Before getting into burgers, he'd been a Chick-fil-A general manager, but decided to open a restaurant he could run with his family. I just wanted a nice family-friendly atmosphere where I could work with my family and not be open on Sunday. Mr. Shope recalls the early days of American burgers with grilled patties on a flat-top stove that draws on the childhood memories of washing down a cheeseburger with a soda, a combination that's never gone out of style. It's a place for people to relax, and it brings back memories of being a kid, for which most people were the easiest time, Mr. Swope said. We offer great burgers that are well prepared with fresh beef and have bottled sodas from all over the country. Well, that's a bit of an understatement. Corbett's has an encyclopedic offering of sodas, including a range of root beers, butterscotch soda from California, and ski soda from the Midwest. The Corbett menu features many of the classic burgers and hot dogs, but features some of its very own. One of the most popular items is the hot dog burger, which combines the two stars of the cookout, the hot dog and the burger, on the same bun. We got the idea from a restaurant in California, he said. It looked good, and we decided to try it. It's been an enormous hit with chili and grilled onions. North Raleigh's Corbett's will be the brand's biggest restaurant in size for a fourth location, Mr. Swope said. He's looking to Fuquay Verena, but likely won't open until 2025. Few ingredients can simultaneously claim to be a wallflower, and an essential cooking staples falls into that category. Neutral oils are exactly what they sound like, oils with little or no discernible flavor. They're a staple of cooking and baking, and chances are you already have one or more of them on your pantry shelves. And here's what you need to know about them. Neutral oils are made from nuts, grains, seeds, or fruits. And among the most common varieties you can find are corn, canola, derived from rapeseed, vegetable, typically a blend that includes corn, canola, soybean, and sunflower oils, avocado, grapeseed, sunflower, safflower, and peanut. These types of oils can be extracted mechanically by pressing the source food or chemically with solvents. Jennifer Cook wrote in a guide to picking oil for Consumer Reports. After that, the oils are often refined with chemicals and high temperatures, which creates uniform color, shelf stability, and their characteristic neutral flavor. Keep in mind that anything labeled as cold-pressed, unrefined, virgin, or extra virgin is unlikely to be neutral in flavor. Olive oil and coconut oils are good examples, though you can find more neutral versions of them. Cooking in extra light olive oils are common. Peanut and avocado oils can also go either way, depending on how they were processed. Some oils, such as walnut and hazelnut, retain their flavor, so they're best in recipes when you want that to come through. As you'd expect, neutral oils are ideal when you don't even want to know they're there. In highly seasoned foods, the characteristic flavor of a fat might not be noticeable, but delicate foods it is. Shirley O. Coraher writes in Cookwise, baking is a prime example, as many cakes, muffins, and quick breads rely on neutral oils for tender, moist texture. While some recipes are designed to take advantage of the characteristic flavor of the more aggressive oils, such as strawberry and pistachio olive oil cake, neutral oils are generally better for cake goods, especially than classic yellow cakes. The choice of oil can make or break some savory applications. A neutral oil is preferred in something like a homemade mayonnaise, where it's just one of several uncooked ingredients. Similarly, canola oil makes an appropriate canvas for other sauces and condiments. Neutral oils deserve a place in your pantry for another big reason: their high smoke points. All fats, including oils, have a smoke point, a point in which they produce smoke. Specifically, it's when anything in the oil, fats, proteins, sugars, and other organic matter start to interact with oxygen and burn, says Joseph Provost, a chemistry and biochemistry professor at the University of San Diego, who co-wrote the book The Science of Cooking, Understanding the Biology and Chemistry Behind Food and Cooking. The refining process removes a lot of the compounds prone to burning, which is extremely helpful when it comes to searing or frying. What happens when your oil burns? It tastes and smells bad. That's what. In addition to the higher smoking points and unassuming flavors, many neutral oils have something else going for them: their relative affordability. Canola and vegetable oils are ideal for a recipe where scale is paramount, such as when you're using large quantities for frying or baking. Other options, such as avocado and even peanut oil, are best used more sparing amounts if you're concerned about your budget. If you have an allergy to peanuts, be careful with peanut oil. The sizzle of a bun hitting a hot pan, the delicate char on roasted potatoes, the aroma of a slice of bread toasting. We associate these sounds and smells of cooking with tasty, nutritious meals. But cooking is also a major source of indoor pollutants. In 2020, Delphine Farmer, a professor of atmospheric chemistry at Colorado State University, co-authored a study that looked at the air quality impact of cooking a full Thanksgiving dinner. The researchers prepared their meal: roast turkeys, stuffing, Brussels sprouts, sweet potato casserole, pies, cranberry sauce and gravy, in a three-bedroom house all fitted with pollution monitoring equipment. They then repeated the experiment on a separate day. The study found that the indoor levels of a particular matter known as PM2.5 was four times higher than the U.S. environmental standards for outdoor pollution. Most countries, including the United States, don't regulate indoor air pollution. PM2.5 gets its name from the size, 2.5 microns, or roughly the size of a single cell of baker's yeast. The particular matter is so small that it easily lodges inside the lungs, where it can trigger asthma attacks, heart attacks, and stroke. The World Health Organization estimates that PM2.5 pollution is responsible for 4.2 million premature deaths each year. Outside the home, PM2.5 mostly comes from burning fossil fuels, such as gasoline in cars and coal for electricity. Indoor cooking is one of the largest known sources. To date, most of the attention to that threat is focused on the cooking surface. Multiple studies have shown that natural gas stoves release significant pollution even when turned off. That includes nitrogen oxides, which are linked to asthma, and benzene, associated with cancer. It also includes methane, a greenhouse gas that doesn't pose a direct threat to human health, but is far more potent than carbon dioxide short term. These drawbacks are often cited by groups and municipalities looking to limit new natural gas infrastructure in buildings and hoping to promote the use of electric and induction stove. But research suggests that the problem isn't with gas stoves alone. Cooking on any surface can add to indoor pollution. It's essentially home chemistry that releases both particle pollution and potentially harmful gases known as volatile organic compounds, known as VOCs. Anytime you put some piece of material, whether it's oil, meat, or vegetable, on the hot surface, you start a series of chemical reactions, and those create a series of chemical products, Dr. Farmer says. Many are delicious chemical products, and they improve safety and digestibility by cooking them properly. The challenge is that you, at the same time, you release a lot of compounds into the air. PM2.5 impacts are relatively straightforward, but VOCs released by cooking are more complicated, in part because not all VOCs are harmful, Dr. Farmer says. If you cut open a lemon, you're smelling a molecule called limonene. It comes out at a very high concentration, but it's not going to do any harm. Burning a meal, on the other hand, can release gases, including isocyanamic acid, a type of VOC that is both a powerful lung irritant and part of a class of compounds likely to have human carcinogens. Your cooking method and what you're cooking also affects the particulars and the gases steamed in the air. Steaming and boiling, for example, don't create as much matter as frying and stir-frying, says Marie Coggins, a senior lecturer in exposure science at the University of Galway in Ireland. We know that cooking meat is worse than cooking vegetables, says Nicola Carslaw, a professor of indoor air chemistry at the University of York in the United Kingdom. And we know that some oils are worse for cooking than others. So you should never heat up olive oil, despite what all those celebrity chefs tell you. The takeaway is not to exist on raw food entirely or to ruin Thanksgiving dinner by boiling the turkey. Rather, researchers say everyone should be paying more attention to home ventilation, especially giving attention to insulation and ensuring homes are tightly sealed. Between wildfire smoke and weather apps that alert us to poor air quality, outdoor pollution is really front and center in recent years, said Dr. Coggins. But people don't join the dots when it comes to indoors. They don't see there's a hazard. She brought her recipes with her nearly 50 years ago when she traveled from Lebanon to the United States. The foundation of one of Triangle's most popular restaurant groups. Cecilia Saha, the matriarch of Raleigh's Nima Mode restaurants, has died, the restaurant group announced. She was 96. Born in Lebanon, she immigrated to the United States in 1976. A year later, the family opened Nima Mode as a bakery specialized in pita breads, founded by her four sons. In 1898, they added a restaurant menu. We've run out of time for this episode of Thought for Food. Please tune in next time. This has been Bob Kruger with the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.